Okay, we are back once again for another spirited discussion of the spirit of the game rules of golf. This is Ed Mate.
And Lewis Harry.
Been a couple weeks. We have been busy. You've been busy running U.S. Open local qualifiers.
Just completed three of our U.S. Open locals.
Well done. No snow.
Thankfully, we have our U.S. Women's Open qualifier today, 36 holes. Decent weather out there today for that. So
out of Walnut Creek, right?
Walnut Creek. One player will squeeze through that field, so good luck to them.
Yeah, but right to the championship, unlike these locals where they have another step in the process.
No, yeah, they got to slug it out for 36 more holes after this before they get in.
Great. It makes the Open great, doesn't it, though? So, well, we're going to save more U.S. Open talk for next month when we get closer to my favorite championship. I'm a unapologetic loyalist. Red, white, and blue. U.S. Open's the best major, but for another time. So this week we're talking PGA Championship.
My championship.
That's right.
As a PGA professional, this is the championship of my association.
That's right. Well, let's start as we did with the Masters. We kind of counted down the top five rulings. These ones might not be quite as well known, but definitely some good stuff to talk about. We're going to kick it off with 1958 and 1957. This is a very strong local tie. Longtime golf professional at the Broadmoor, Dow Finsterwald, was a finalist in the 19. Yes, I said finalist, because in 1957, that was the last year the PGA Championship was held at match play. They changed that in 1958, and lo and behold, Dow, improved by one slot and won the tournament. So that's quite a history for Dow there, having been in the finals in 57. Might have been really a better story, I guess, if he had won. Although you could argue he could say, well, I lost in the final, so I appealed for them to change it to stroke play. And
I was going to say, I think he might be a fan of the stroke play change in that scenario.
Yeah, Dow is, again, I got to know Dow during the course of my career here in the state of Colorado, and what an amazing career. But pretty interesting. A lot of people think that the PJ should have stuck with match play, and it would have continue to separate them from the other majors. We've seen since then whatever it is now, the Dell, previously the Accenture match play, kind of carve out a pretty good niche on the PGA Tour. I think it's kind of a welcome relief from the week-to-week stroke play. But nevertheless, they made that change in 1958, and it's remained that way to this day.
Yeah, and I think, people might say that, by sticking with match play, the PGA might have an identity of its own or some way to differentiate itself from the other three majors. But I think the argument against that is, you could have the world's best player just draw the wrong slot in round one and get knocked out and change the course of major championship history. I actually think that the PGA is perfectly fine with going to stroke play. It has some consistency with all the other majors being stroke play, all four stroke play. The another local tie, yes, and more so to me, but the 1958 PGA was held at Lanark Country Club. In my 5.5 years when I lived in Philly, I lived roughly about 15, 20 minutes away from Lanark Country Club. Played it a handful of times. It's got one of the dumbest centerline trees on the 18th hole that I've contested with a few times, but
So they haven't hosted anything really of consequence since then.
The issue with Lanark, it just doesn't have the infrastructure to host any championships anymore. It's a great golf course. Roughly maxes out at 6,900 yards, mm-hmm. and it's not a long enough golf course to host anything. But in its day in 1958, fabulous championship venue.
Great. All right, what else you got on our top five? We're going to go to number four.
So moving up the ladder, this one's a little more recent. This one occurred in 2013, PGA Championship at Oak Hill up in upstate New York, where Jason Duffner ended up winning that championship. However, for another competitor, their championship did not go that same way that Jason Duffner's did. Woody Austin, at this time, Woody Austin was nearing the end of what was somewhat of a competitive career. He's done okay for himself on the Champions Tour at this point, but Woody Austin, first round, he was penalized 4 strokes for having too many clubs in the bag. I know this is a little somewhat topical because we've recently filmed a video featuring the 14-club limit, soon to be debuting on the CGA website. But for Woody Austin, he had too many clubs in his bag for the first 2 holes. He was penalized for each of those holes, 2 strokes. Thankfully, that stroke penalty is capped at 4 strokes. Still this way in 2019 under the current rules. If Woody Austin would have done this in the 2020 PGA Championship, still would have been penalized 4 strokes and still would have been capped for the first 2 holes of that occurrence.
Do you know which club it was? Did he have an extra wedge? Did he have an extra driver?
Yeah, in my reading, it didn't mention it.
Yeah. I'm sure he handled it in typical calm, cool, collected Woody Austin. Didn't bash his putter against his head.
I was going to say,
fell into a pond.
With the character that Woody is, I'm sure that he took it in perfect stride.
Well, one thing you have to give Woody credit for, he certainly blames himself, as we've seen. He takes it out on his own head. Yeah, it's as Lewis said, we're going to be talking more about that here in a couple of weeks. It's a fascinating rule, and it's 1938 that rule came into the book. And I know the penalty clause is probably the thing that most people get tripped up by, because it's got this weird when you apply the penalty. In stroke play, it's pretty straightforward. You get into a match play situation, and it gets pretty dicey. Maybe we should talk about that.
So the other thing in match play that's a little bit different than stroke play is it's a adjustment of hole penalty in match play. So there's not many penalties in match play. Previous to 1958 in the PGA Championship, this might have been the case. But in match play, there's not a ton of penalties that are adjustment of holes. And in this scenario, with exceeding the 14-club limit, the match is going to be adjusted by the holes in which that player breached this rule on. So if a player discovers it on the third tee box, and that breach occurred on the first 2 holes, and that player won those 2 holes, well, that match is all square again.
Right.
The match is adjusted backwards for those holes that were the breach occurred, and they're going to play on from there.
Yeah, the interesting thing here, and having just taken the rules test, I don't know if they tested your knowledge of this, but where you discover the breach is one of the USGA's favorite things to do to trip you up. And here's the way I kind of think of this. Let's say you and I are playing a match, and I hit a wrong ball on the third hole, middle of the fairway, I hit a wrong ball. That hole's over. We might as well go to 4. It's done. Now let's say this situation occurred. I'm in the middle of the third fairway, and I discover that I've got too many clubs. I got to play hard because it's not a loss of hole penalty on that hole. So there's something still at stake to play for. So it's a very unique penalty clause, and as I said, one the USGA loves to trip us up on tests.
Yeah, you don't see a lot of Rule 4 questions on the USGA rules exam. At least in the last one I took, I didn't think I saw a lot of Rule 4 questions.
Yeah. Who knows?
Maybe I saw one, I didn't realize it. But
yeah.
It is that specific penalty structure for more than 14 clubs is a little bit something you have to pay attention to.
One ball rule also apply there? If the one ball rule is in effect.
Model of rule G4.
Same
penalty clause.
Can you think of any too many caddies? 2 caddies, is that kind of similar? How many, if you had 2 caddies working for you, does that also apply here?
I believe so. I think with 2 caddies, there's no limit on, like there is with
you could
clubs.
Get a 36 hole.
So you could, you could rack
36
up,
stroke.
Yeah. Rack up quite the tab for penalty strokes.
That better be a really good second caddy.
I don't know if the second caddy is going to shave that many strokes negate the difference. Yeah. But we'll keep rolling here.
Let's move on. Number 3, we had 2 of them, 2012. Remind me who won. Was this Jason Duffner?
This was Rory.
Oh, Rory, right. This is the year before. And now we're at we are not at Whistling Straits, but we're at
Kiawah in this scenario.
Right. So you're going to take the first one.
So first of 2 scenarios. And with Kiawah Islands, obviously just recently hosted the PGA Championship recently.
Last year.
Everybody's favorite champion.
Yeah.
Soon to be debuting in this year's PGA Championship, what it seems like. He's on the active field list.
Yeah.
But 2012 PGA, our first scenario here, Michael Hooey, Ed and I were just discussing this, like who doesn't know Michael Hooey, but got himself into, when I was reading more into this, it didn't say if it was in a bunker or if it was in what was then known as through the green, but moved around some sand to identify a ball. Actually in my notes here, it does say bunker. So excuse me, he wasn't a bunker, but it's moving around some sand to identify a ball. And as we know, players entitled to a fair search of his golf ball. He was fairly entitled to move some sand to identify to make sure that was his ball. However, he failed to recreate the lie that he had altered during that search. Played the stroke, played out the hole, continued playing his round. However, it didn't include what was the penalty on his card, signed for the card. And at that time, a failure to include a penalty was a DQ. It was resulting as he signed for a lower score than he made on that that card. Got disqualified because of it. Had this happened a year later in 2013, he probably would have been saved at this point by what was then 33-7. Committee could have stepped in that scenario, similar to the Tiger Woods scenario we talked about in our Masters podcast. But the committee could have saved him from a DQ here and then applied the two-stroke penalty for that fail to recreate that lie. Unfortunately, 33-7 didn't come into effect until about a year later. So Michael Hui in this scenario, because he failed to recreate the lie, played that shot, didn't include the penalty and signed that card, got DQ'd from the championship.
Well, and now it's no longer 33-7. This is just covered by the new rule.
Yeah, now this is now getting into back where we discussed with our Masters podcast, 33-7 doesn't exist anymore. So under Rule 1 now, the committee has to apply the rules the way they're written. The committee doesn't have a discretion on disqualifications versus penalty applications. The committees have to apply penalties the way they're written. However, also in Rule 1, that there is a provision for failure to include an unknown penalty. And in this scenario, failing to include an unknown penalty today, you would just get that penalty retroactively applied to your score. No disqualification for that failure to include an unknown penalty. So if Michael Hui had done this in the most recent Kiawah Island PGA Championship, again, would have been saved from a disqualification, would have just got the two-stroke penalty on his card retroactively applied.
So that same year, and I remember this because he was very much in contention, Carl Pettersson was in contention that year, and he was in a lateral, or he was in a, I think it was a lateral penalty area. It was known as a lateral water hazard then, and he moved a loose impediment. And he got a two-stroke penalty, and it was of consequence because he wasn't, unlike Michael Hui, he was actually a factor. Another quick aside on Carl Pettersson, he was a anchorer, so he'd have two problems. I guess it'd be good news, bad news. The good news for Carl Pettersson today is no longer a penalty for moving that loose impediment in a penalty area. He can do that. The bad news is he can't anchor anymore. And matter of fact, I have not heard a thing about Carl Pettersson since the anchoring rule went in. Maybe that was his crutch.
That could have been the nail in the coffin in his career. I don't pay a ton of attention to the European Tour, I guess what is now known as the DP World Tour. Yeah. But who knows? He could have, been riding out into the sunset on the European Tour and had a very profitable last couple
years. Maybe he's
going to
play in the Saudi thing. Maybe he's getting appearance money.
Yeah, good for him.
And I wonder if they're going to let you anchor, because Sergio's kind of made it sound like you can't wait to get off the PGA Tour. Kind of a lot of discussion in social media suggesting that means reading the tea leaves that he's headed to the LIV Golf Tour. Apparently, they're not going to have rules officials, right? Is that what you
from what I understand, they might have their own code of rules.
Or knowing their ethics, they might have really serious penalties too. I don't know. So let that one lie.
Not sure which way we want to look at that, but
yeah. All right, what else you got here? We're getting to number two on the list.
Number two, 2016 PGA Championship at Baltusrol. This was, Jimmy Walker was the champion in this one.
Yeah.
And another guy who hasn't really done a lot in the last couple of years.
He got Lyme disease or something.
Something like that. He hasn't had a ton of success on the golf course in recent years.
Seems like this happens a lot. Somebody wins a major and then it's like, okay, career over. I don't know. Think about Sean McKeel. Wasn't a major, but Craig Perks won the Players' Championship, disappeared. So he kind of, Jimmy Walker, who was a really, he came up.
Great ball strike.
Yeah.
But 2016 PGA Championship at Baltusrol, I believe the championship took place on the lower course at Baltusrol.
Yeah.
Two golf courses there, lower and upper. But in this championship, if anyone remembers, the weather was not spectacular throughout the championship. There was some cold days. Which was unusual at that time for May. Some rain had fallen earlier in the week, rain in the first round. But late Saturday night, rainstorm moved in upper New Jersey, dumped roughly in the neighborhood of a couple inches of rain. Golf course was soaked. Rather than delaying the championship to Monday, because I believe the next part of that early that next week, there was more rain forecasted for northern New Jersey at that point. So rather than keep pushing off the championship with one round to be played, PGA of America put in what was, what most people know is lift, clean, and place, but what's the proper term is preferred lies. So preferred lies were in effect for the final round of the 2016 PGA at Baltusrol. Before that, it was almost unheard of, or was unheard of, for preferred lies to be in effect for a major championship. So this is believed to be the first occurrence of preferred lies being in effect for a major championship. With all the what seems like outrage, and I follow the PGA Tour communications account on Twitter for one reason and one reason only, and it's to see the replies when they tweet out that preferred lies are in effect for a tournament. Because for some reason, people, I say people, but golf fans just can't wrap their heads around professional golfers lift cleaning and placing in closely mown areas. So for preferred lies to be in effect for a major championship, and not only for a major championship, but for the final round of a major championship when a champion is to be crowned, it was unusual at the time. Mm-hmm. I attended the 2016 PGA of Baltusrol on the Saturday of that before the final round. The golf course was already somewhat damp. Mm-hmm. There were some occurrences of embedded balls and some temporary, what was then known as casual water around the golf course. So it's not all that shocking that preferred lies were used. It's just the going into effect for a major championship for the final round was a big deal then in 2016.
Yeah, I remember it. I remember Kerry Haig, who's the chief championship officer, I think is his title for the PGA of America. I thought he handled it really well. He's one of the best in the business. I thought the PGA of America handled it well. I believe Pete Bevacqua was the CEO then, and I noticed by contrast that same year there was a fairly notable ruling that the USGA had, and again this is a bit of a criticism of our mothership here, the USGA. I think it's very hard for the CEO to also be running the championship, their marquee championship. I think that it's just the optics of that are not great, and it allowed Pete Bevacqua to be the CEO and make sure that the sponsors are happy and the organization is protected. And the bad cop was Kerry Haig. And boy, he did a great job explaining it. And he's so authoritative, but in a very likable way. He has a great way with people. And I thought that he handled it really well. This whole idea of preferred lies, I was watching a couple weeks ago there in Maryland. The conditions were, again, wet. Mm-hmm. And of course, it's now commonplace. It's almost becoming the default. That's probably an exaggeration, but it feels like it's becoming the default now for the PGA Tour to play preferred lies. My son, who's 21 years old, has just recently taken an interest in golf. Better late than never, I guess. And we were watching it, and I was explaining to him, it was Max Homa and Keegan Bradley, and they were neck and neck, and Homa was on the green, and Keegan Bradley was off. And I made a point to explain to my son, normally he can't lift and clean that ball because he was well off the green, decided he was going to putt it. But to somebody watching golf, it's like, I think they'd be led to believe it's okay to mark and lift your ball all the time. Often it seems like they very rarely show it happening. It's almost like they're embarrassed by it. So, but in this case, they showed it because there was only two players in contention. So, I don't know. I understand. I guess we talk about spirit of the game, letter of the law. The muddy ball rule, as they called it back in the 20s, was introduced to allow players to lift clean their ball on the putting green. Really supporting that philosophy. It's a ground game, and you don't want a big flat tire ka-clunk, ka-clunk, ka-clunk on the putting green. And now with mud on a ball on even in the general area, as precise as these players are now, the vagaries of and unpredictability of what might happen with mud on a ball, I just think it's now almost, I wonder if we're going to get to a point where we're just going to allow you to lift clean all the time.
Well, I hope not in that scenario, but it's important to know, if you're not familiar with preferred lies, there's actually two different rules for lift, clean, and place. Mm-hmm. So a lot of people just say lift, clean, and place, and they think it applies across the board to what we know as preferred lies. But when we're talking about those model local rules that preferred lies falls under, model local rule E3 is preferred wise. That's our general idea of lift, clean, and place. You know, we're marking our golf ball, we're lifting it, cleaning it, and it's being placed within a certain distance of that original spot that the ball lies. Sometimes it's a scorecard, sometimes it's a foot, sometimes it's a club length. Whatever the committee decides is there going to be that relief area for preferred lies. Going back one monoloke rule to E2, there's a monoloke rule called cleaning ball. Now, it's similar to preferred lies, but in this scenario, you don't get that club length. Mm. You don't get that scorecard length to place the ball. What you have to do when you clean the ball is you're allowed to mark it, lift it, clean it, but that ball has to be replaced on its exact original spot. Mm. So there are two different scenarios there with lift, clean, and place. One might allow you to get a more preferred lie. The other is going to require you to place that ball back on its original spot.
No, I didn't know that there were... That's interesting. I didn't know that.
So
I just always assumed preferred lies gave you some distance.
Yep.
And I guess the committee would, can you think of a scenario where they'd use the cleaning, the first one, or the just cleaning it and replacing it versus it, I guess when there's a little, it's just more dry but muddy sort of? Yeah.
So that would be the scenario. And actually, if you, where I've seen monoloke rule E2 for cleaning ball is in a scenario where it's not wet enough to warrant preferred lies to where balls are going to be either being embedded or you're going to have temporary water issues, but maybe it rained the day before. Some of the water dried out. Some is not. There's some mud around. A ball might splat on the fairway and roll forward 4 feet, but now you have a ball covered in mud.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than letting that player, you know, lift that ball and place it within a club length on a more favorable spot, well, that player's, all he was really doing is he's getting the option to lift the ball, clean it, and put it back down. So that would be a scenario where you could use E2 rather than E3.
Seems like there would be a risk if you were to do that of people, players not understanding that distinction. You'd have to be really emphatic. You're not, you don't get a club length, and you could totally see players just operating under that assumption.
With E2 being such a very rarely used monoloke rule, what I've always done, and I've only used it once, and this was a very rare scenario, but what I would always do when I use preferred lies is I have these printouts in bright yellow paper with MLR E3 preferred lies on the starter's box.
Mm-hmm.
And so every player can see what is being used as preferred lies. In the event of E2 being used instead of E3, which is cleaning ball, I would replace that printout with something that says that the ball must be replaced on the original spot rather than that whatever that committee decides is the length that the players may be able to place within for the other rule.
Okay, I think we beat that one to death. Yeah.
That was more in depth than I thought our preferred lies was.
That's right. All right, number one, who can forget is we're at Whistling Straits 2010. Before we talk about Dustin Johnson in the quote unquote bunker on 18 in the 2-stroke penalty he got for grounding his club, you told me something before we started recording about that I didn't know, that we weren't even supposed to be at Whistling Straits.
That's right. The 2010 PGA Championship did occur at Whistling Straits. However, was not originally scheduled for Whistling Straits. This move happened in 2005, so about 5 years prior to the championship. PGA of America moved the championship, what was supposed to be then at Sahali Country Club in Seattle, to Whistling Straits. Unfortunately, the move had nothing to do with golf in itself, but the move had to do with the Olympics in Vancouver.
Okay.
The Olympics in Vancouver at that time were sparsely attended. The fan support for the Olympics was, I don't want to say dismal, but it was less than what you would normally think for an Olympics. So seeing the reaction and the fan support that the Olympics in Vancouver had received kind of spooked PGA of America a little bit. They didn't want that same thing to happen to their championship at Sahali Country Club.
Which so rather, they held before Vijay Singh won there.
Vijay Singh was the previous winner at Sahali. So rather than come up with a game plan to do something about that or figure out a solution to a problem that hasn't happened yet, they yanked the championship, moved it to Whistling Straits, which at that point previously, I believe it was maybe 04, 03, one of the previous championships that just recently happened at Whistling Straits was wildly attended, wildly popular for PGA of America. Mm-hmm. It was a great move for them. So they reassigned the 2010 PGA Championship from Sahali Country Club to Whistling Straits in response to an Olympics that wasn't even in the same country.
Okay. That's a good little
unfortunately
fact.
For Sahali, PGA of America has not returned a PGA Championship there. It's a 6,800-yard golf course.
Right.
It's what's needed for infrastructure for a major championship today isn't going to work for Sahali.
Yeah, I was there for the Senior Open, and it was probably before this. I can't remember. Late 2000s, but I think maybe before 2010.
In what I believe to be a makeup to Sahali, PGA of America did end up taking the Women's PGA Championship, which was then known as something a little bit different before PGA of America got involved. But the Women's PGA Championship ended up going to Sahali.
Okay.
That's what I envision remedy.
Dustin Johnson probably would have been happy if they'd stuck with Sahali, because he does not have happy memories of Whistling Straits. So, again, I think this is one of the more infamous rulings in the history of the sport, for the fact that he was right there in contention, vying to either get into a playoff or win outright. He hits his ball right, well outside the fairway. The way the golf course was roped, this entire area, this hillside to the right of 18 at Whistling Straits, was littered with small bunkers. And I've worked championships there, and they're just everywhere. You missed a fairway, you're pretty much in a bunker. So they had to, but they're not rakes in them. Some might, when you get closer to the greens, have rakes in them. But for the most part, these are just sort of wild, unkept bunkers. Well, over the course of the week, those bunkers got trampled down to almost dirt. And here's Dustin Johnson on the hillside. His ball is in the bunker. By definition, they issued a notice to explain and clarify, which apparently he didn't read.
Not only did PGA of America issue that notice, I believe that notice had been posted in locker rooms, restrooms, anywhere players might have gone for the week. That notice was posted for those players to see. Similar to the notice they posted this past year at Kiawa, where there are no bunkers on Kiawa. They're all waste areas. Yeah. So PGA of America has always done a pretty good job of relaying that information. However, as I'll let you continue, this information didn't seem to get relayed to DJ.
Apparently not. And the other thing that made it even more hard to swallow for Dustin, because I'm kind of sympathetic on this one, even though I think players should and absolutely need to read those notices and know that protect themselves, protect the field. They have a walking referee with these groups. And easy to look back on this and be critical and say, why didn't the walking referee intervene and make sure, knowing that this could be a problem, make sure to protect the player from that happening. So anyway, the difference, the reason waste area versus bunker is important, and this is still true today, you are not allowed to ground your club in a bunker. You are allowed to lightly ground your club in a sandy area in the general area, which is basically what a waste area would be, because there is no definition of waste areas, to my knowledge. It's not one of the five areas that we define.
It's not a definition in the rules of golf.
Yeah. So at any rate, here's the key. He's hitting this shot, and it's basically dirt. It doesn't even look like a bunker. And by the end of the week, it had been trampled, and there were people standing in the bunker with him.
I believe there are even people standing in that bunker prior to him arriving to that shot.
So how many times does a PGA Tour player hit a shot out of a bunker with spectators standing in the bunker? So here he is. The optics of the shot is like, and between the hard pan the lie had become, the people standing in the bunker, I think it would have been, I understand totally, even if he had read the notice, it would have been pretty darn impressive if Dustin Johnson had the wherewithal to have read that and to have questioned it. And I think 9 players out of 10 would have done exactly what he did. Cost him 2 strokes, and boy, talk about having to be the bearer of bad news. Comes off that green, and instead of believing he's going to be in a playoff, because he bogeyed the hole without the 2 strokes, he ends up 1 stroke or 2 strokes, whatever it was, out of a playoff. I remember that shot of him sitting in the scoring trailer, pushing his hat back and just, having that look of complete devastation on his face.
Yeah, I do. I always remember the shot of, and you can go back and you can do a Google image search for this, but I remember the shot of him. He's kind of standing with one hand on his hip and his hat off. There's a PGA of America official there standing with his arm on DJ's shoulder as he's explaining what had just occurred and what the penalty would be for that breach. And that's the image, the lasting image that I think of.
How would you like to be that referee? You get on the radio, and number one, you're being told that the group you are responsible for is just one of the players who's right in contention, has a chance to win the championship, has been assessed a 2-stroke penalty, and you get to tell him. That would be a tough one.
So. That would be, yeah. I'll knock on wood that I've never had to experience that so far.
Yeah. Well, as I've always said, you never want to be a famous rules official, because the only rules officials who become famous are ones who make mistakes or have to deliver news like that. You want to be out of sight, out of mind, quietly giving correct rulings and exiting as quickly as you can.
But how different would today be had DJ won the 2010 PGA and not Martin Keimer?
Yeah. Yeah.
DJ might be a different player today.
And didn't Keimer beat Bubba Watson in a playoff or something? I may have it mixed up.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I know Keimer was the winner there.
Yeah,
I think he
ended up going into a playoff, and it would have been a three-way playoff had that penalty not been assessed. But again, the moral of the story is read the notice, read the rules. You are responsible for applying penalties. And just as we've talked here, there's a couple players, one who got disqualified for failing to apply a penalty and one who cost him a championship. So once again, whether you're at a spirit of the game or a letter of the law, you better read it.
It's always important to know where your ball lies on the golf course. You know, the five areas of the golf course seem like such an elementary part of the rules. But as we see, it depends on where your ball is. There's different rules that apply and there's different breaches that could happen.
All right, we'll wrap it there. Enjoy the PGA, and we'll be back, I'm sure, very soon with some other great insights into the rules of golf.
All right. Till the next time.